Hello, everybody. Tim Riddle here from the Discover Blind Spots podcast, where we believe what you don't see can actually hurt you. Hey, how many of you are marked by love? Tough question, right? Don't you think? I mean, it probably depends on what day it is. You know, if I'm being totally honest and transparent, there are some days that I don't feel very loving. Recently, I sat down with Tim Stevens, who is an author of a new book entitled simply Marked by Love. I've known Tim for about 10 years or so now. We first met while both serving as executive pastors at our respective churches. Tim now serves as the vice president of consulting for Vanderblumen, an executive search firm for the church world and nonprofits, and I think even higher ed as the most recent addition to their offerings. I've always had a tremendous amount of respect for Tim, his leadership, and his wisdom. I've read several of his books in the past, but this one is different. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It challenged me greatly, and I would highly recommend you add it to your reading list. Here's my conversation with Tim Stevens. Tim Stevens, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Glad to talk to you today.
Yeah, I was thinking in the past few days as I was sort of preparing for this and reminiscing a little bit, and as we talked a little bit off mic here just a minute ago, that we've exchanged some texts. We really haven't talked in a little while, and I was thinking back to how we first met. And I guess it was the Executive Pastor Coaching Network that you had back, the very first one that
10,
you launched.
11 years ago, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, probably at least that. I think I was in that very first class. And then when you launched that, you relaunched that again at your current place of employment with Vanderblumen, I joined up again and did that. And so that was, just to give a little shout out for you, that was both times were great experiences. Highly encourage people to consider that. It's a great few days. I know you've kind of changed maybe how that works, whether it's over, you know, one time or 3 months or six, I can't remember, but I just remember my time there was so helpful. I don't know if you want to say anything about that or not, but it's good stuff.
Yeah, you were one of the guinea pigs. Thank you for going out on a limb with me. But it must have been probably maybe 12 years ago now, but started with meeting usually around 12 to 15 executive pastors or equivalent. A lot of churches don't call them that, but a lot of times it's an executive director, it's an operations person, it's an administrative person. But we gather together and talk about leadership and issues that are pertinent to the person that's in the number two chair. That's, you know, leading a staff, leading a team, maybe working with an elder board, trying to lead up with their senior pastor and a lot of the nuances of that. So the way we do it now is we do it in the spring and the fall, and each group will come for a total of 6 days. So it's two trips to Houston. The first trip is 3 days. For example, this coming spring, we have a group come in February for 3 days, and then they'll come back in May for the same group in May for 3 days. Really get to know each other at a pretty deep level, and you walk away with friends, networked with people that are going through similar things, facing some of the same things, and so it's really a great time. I still enjoy doing it.
Yeah, I know when each time that I was there, one of the first of all, I think we walked away with tangible stuff, which was good. So it wasn't just sitting around, you know, kind of navel gazing, so to speak. Yeah. I mean, literally, you walk away with some real tangible things that you can implement. But the other thing that was really healthy was I think I walked away and said, wow, I'm really not crazy. You know, there are other people who are dealing with some of the same stuff. And I think we'd need that as leaders. Sometimes in our lives, we need to be reminded of that. So tell me, I always like when I do the interviews and the podcast here, I always like to put a little context behind the interview. And although, you know, almost all the world knows who you are, but maybe some don't. You know, it might be 1% that doesn't know who Tim Stevens is. But just in case, talk a little bit about, kind of bring us up to date, you know, maybe with your career and where you are now with Vanderblumen and what you do and so forth before we jump into this new book that you just released.
Yeah, thanks. No, thanks for asking. So, yeah, I've kind of had three chapters, I guess, to my career so far. First 9 years I spent working with an organization called Life Action Ministries, and this was a nonprofit organization that worked in churches, and really cool opportunity. I traveled around the country, probably spent time personally in and working with somewhere around 700 or 800 churches. So really got this tremendous experience, kind of broad experience. This is in my 20s, you know, just of kind of the largeness of the church world and the different ways that that churches and Christians are advancing the kingdom. And then in that, as I was working at that organization, met my wife, we got married, we started attending this church, this startup church that was meeting in a movie theater near where we lived. And we just, like, our own personal walk was kind of becoming alive in that. So ultimately went on staff there. The church was 200 people, 250, something like that. It's called Granger Community Church, and only maybe 5-6 years old at the time, and kind of got in on the ground floor. I joked later that they probably wouldn't have hired me if I hadn't got in on the ground floor, but got to be able to come alongside the pastor as an executive pastor. And just kind of, you know, he would always say his job was to lead the church, my job was to run the church, and together we kind of did both of those things. But a great partnership. Stayed there 20 years. Church grew to 5,000 or 6,000 during that season. That's when you and I met.
Right.
Towards the middle of that season, or latter half maybe. And then 2014 just kind of began to feel an itch, a sense, a call, a release. I don't know what the word is. Ultimately walked away from Granger and joined an organization called Vanderblumen Search Group. And how I kind of got into that is I had been looking at hired, you know, a lot of people over the years. We had 130 on staff when I left. But one time I got up to about 3 years before I left, I was like, okay, like, we've looked for this guy. We're trying to start a campus. We don't have someone internal. I don't know where to look. I've tapped all my networks, heard about this upstart organization called Vanderblumen Search Group that helped churches find staff. And so that was successful for us. We found that pastor, kind of developed this relationship with the organization and with the leaders here, and ultimately came on staff in 2014. So been doing this for 4.5 years. I lead a team of consultants that we work with churches all over the country and some outside the country, and just help them fill key roles. Sometimes it's working with a search committee, helping them with a senior pastor transition, or all different kinds of staff roles. And then we also work with, like, nonprofit ministries, Christian schools for, like, head of school kind of positions. We work some with faith-based businesses like a Dave Ramsey, those kinds of things. So having the time of my life, love what I get to do. Live in Houston now. We have a team of 44 on our staff that we kind of do this together. So that's where I'm at today.
Yeah. And I've utilized Vanderblumen and your services in the previous church that I worked for, which was a larger church, several staff members, and obviously I'm a testament, or can testify, that it was very effective. The staff members that we hired are still there and doing great and flourishing. And I always say, when people would ask, I say, we found staff members we would have never found, mm-hmm. and would have never found us, if we didn't have this, you know, this group helping us, this company helping us. And then also with another church that I was just sort of helping out as an interim while I was on staff at the previous church. And it was a smaller church of literally about a little over 100 people. And I remember calling you that day and saying, you really think you can help a church this size? And mm-hmm. you said, yeah, I think we can. And of course, I spent a little time with that church. I remember the first time I said, I think we could, you know, you guys should consider hiring this, you know, this company to help you find your next pastor. And, you know, after they looked at me like I had three heads, like we would pay somebody to do that. They, you know, kind of a series of events, and they ended up hiring you, and they have their pastor who's still there. It's been, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years now, at least, and they love him. In fact, I just saw one of their members just earlier this morning, and she said, "We love him." And now, if you went to, you know, if I was sitting with them and I said, you know, so what's your thoughts about the value of doing that? Their comments would be, it's a no-brainer. So yeah, good stuff. Much needed in the church world, as that world is constantly changing. But you guys provide a tremendous service to churches and organizations and so forth. You bring an expertise that obviously most organizations just don't have the staffing or the ability to do that.
Well, it's a lot of fun. And I remember that one. That was Brick Church. And yes, it was at that time the smallest church we'd ever worked with. Now we've done many, many churches under 150, under 100. I just finished working with a church in central Iowa that's maybe on a good Sunday, has about 90 people coming. And I tell you what, there's something, you know, a lot very fulfilling with working with a church that size, where you're able to kind of expand their network and you're able to kind of go across the country and tell their story and find a leader to a pastor to fit a position like that. That's a, you know, that makes the work really fun and exciting.
Yeah. I know we got to get to your book, but I will say this. I remember this as you were saying that. So with Brick, they had gone through their own process, and after about 3 or 4 months, I think they had about 12 resumes. And, you know, with a smaller church like that, sometimes the feeling is, do you think anybody would want to come? You think anybody would want to be our, and I remember saying, gosh, it would be a privilege for somebody to, an honor to be able to lead this church. And then I remember when you guys were officially hired, literally 30 days later, I think you had close to 100 resumes that had, you know, obviously they didn't have to look at 100. You guys do all the heavy lifting of that. And I remember going back to them and telling them that, and it was almost like you saw a bounce in their step, like, wait a minute, you know, like somebody really does want us, you know, kind of thing. So that was really kind of a cool experience.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And those are the stories you love to hear, because you just, and even, you know, years later, we don't often hear a story like this where, you know, 3 or 4 years later, we're still hearing stories out of the church. So it's really cool to hear that they're doing well.
Yeah, they love him. They certainly do. So this book that I have been diving into over the past few weeks, truly love the book. Told you this offline, you're speaking my language and some of this, entitled Marked by Love. When I read it, of course, you know, this is called the Discover Blind Spots podcast, and my head has been in this idea, this concept of blind spots. And when I started reading the book, I wrote this down and I put it in my notes here. One of the biggest blind spots of those who claim to follow Jesus, I think, is this idea of we forget really what it means to be sort of marked by love.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? That's my biggest fear with the title and putting the book out was that anyone would assume that I think I've, you know, accomplished or I've won the game on this thing called love. And I feel like it's a journey. I'm working on it every day. I worked on it this morning on my drive in with the traffic in Houston. It's where every day we have these opportunities to either be people of love or not in every interaction and every conversation. And so it's something, it's a sense of personal journey, partly frustration with the world around me, the Christian world around me, and frustration with myself at times.
You know, one of the things that I noticed was immediately in the introduction, I guess, you know, you talk about a little bit of a car rage story. And I remember when I started reading, I thought, wow, I mean, lots of transparency in this book. I don't think if people open the, you know, the book and get beyond the title, they're going to quickly know how transparent you are and not saying, you know, hey, I've got this thing figured out. Talk a little bit. This is different from your other books. In fact, you make a statement in the book. You say every other book came from your head. This one came from your heart. But talk about that, because I've read not all of your other books, but several of them. And this one was radically different, and I loved it. So what kind of stirred in you to do that?
Yeah, great question. All of my other books came kind of out of like what I'd learned in my work. And so my work was with churches, my work was as a pastor. And so it was, there were leadership oriented books for church leaders. They were books on how do you do well leading volunteers? How do you do well in organizing and administrating in a church context? How do you do well reaching people through leveraging culture? So this book was less about my work and more just about my kind of personal journey, personal frustration, a little bit of kind of untangling. You know, a lot of people go through, if people grew up in the church, they will often, a journey is you kind of, you have your parents' faith, you go to church, you kind of adopt it, you know, you make a decision for Christ, maybe you go to a Christian college, maybe you, but at some point there comes this kind of a struggle, a wrestling with, okay, what do I believe? And what does that mean for me? And for me, I think I was a late bloomer because I think I was probably 40 when I started really to start unraveling and kind of poking holes in some of what I'd always kind of heard and learned and believed, and began to kind of rebuild that. And as I was rebuilding it, it just seemed to me like the essence kept coming down to this love thing and the sense that that's what I'm called to do. Like there's a whole lot I can't understand. There's a whole lot I'll never know. There's you know, thousands of denominations that have broken up because of little nuanced essential or what they feel like are essential issues for them. And for me, it's like, I don't know about all that stuff. Like, I'm not going to be able to argue that stuff. But what I do know is that Jesus called me to be marked by love, to be a disciple.
Yeah, good stuff. As I was going through the book, if it's okay, I pulled some quotes out of there that really, you know, that I underlined and really stuck with me. And I'd love to get your, just really your take on it. Chapter 2, you say, it's as though when you become a Christian, you sign a pledge to be fake and you're issued a mask. Wear this and don't ever take it off. The whole thing crumbles if people see you without your mask.
Yeah. And that's kind of describes some of the struggle or some of my journey as I'm kind of unraveling some of this stuff. And there's a sense, you know, you'd ask questions, and in Christian context, in church context, in Bible studies, and I just could start to see that if people didn't have the answer, then they'd kind of over spiritualize it.
Yeah.
And you know, just pray more, read your Bible more. This wasn't meant to be understood. Just, you know, you got to believe by faith. It's not going to make sense to you. It's almost like kind of check your head at the door and, it'll all be okay. And, you know, yet you kind of look and you can kind of get carried away with this, you know, of the sense of like, okay, people are hypocrites and there's people that aren't living what they're saying and all that. And that can really derail a lot of people. And that wasn't it for me, but it was a sense of like, okay, I get that. And there's a lot of knowledge in that. And there's a lot of, I'm sure, theology behind that. But like, why are you so angry in your emails? Or why, when you put the comment on the blog or the response on the Facebook, you don't look like a follower of Jesus? And so what does that mean for me? Like, I'm not going to answer for anyone else, but what does that mean for me? And how do I kind of do that better? So this whole thing of like to be vulnerable, to be transparent, just, I mean, this is who I am. This is the journey I'm on. Yeah, I just messed up. I just yelled at a guy when I was driving it. You know, those kinds of things. It's like, to me, that gets me to where I want to be and where I need to be versus where I should be.
You talk a lot about, you know, this idea of rules and expectations and obligations. And, you know, I've often wondered, as I've reflected, you know, and as we get older in this life, you know, I've wondered sometimes if Jesus comes back or when Jesus comes back or if Jesus right now is looking and saying, what the heck is all of this? You know, I didn't intend for this to be all these, you know, and there's lots of tremendous churches. So this is not a knock at churches or anything, but sometimes I do believe we get caught up in trying to be these little mini corporations. You know, I just wonder, you know, and I was a proponent of that, you know, so, but sometimes I find myself questioning and saying, would Jesus come back and say, what in the world? This is not what I had intended at all. And I think there's a thread of that throughout your whole book, that you're a point that you're making a little bit as well, not to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I was on the hamster wheel for a lot of years in trying to build that. I think what some, and I'm a big fan, I'm a proponent of having churches that are relevant and
sure.
that make sense for people and that help kind of decipher and disentangle from your past. And but I think what we sometimes miss, and especially those of us that are leaders in churches, is we can spend so much time on the organization.
Yeah.
That we get so far away from just walking with people, hearing their pain, loving them, accepting them where they're at, listening to them, living a life of love in front of them. All of that, we can kind of get away from that because we're just so busy on the wheel and
yeah.
just kind of doing the next thing and trying to build the organization. And now that it's built, like, man, we need $13,000 in the offering every week to keep going, or $13 million or whatever the number is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just like, so we got to do more, because if we don't do more, then people won't give, and then we can't do more. And so that can get tiring after a while. And again, there's a whole lot of good to it. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing that. I'm just saying, like, as an individual, like, that's, I get that for organization, but as an individual, what does that mean for me? And for me, it's like pouring into relationships, make a difference in people's lives.
Talk a little bit about this. You dove in a little bit around chapters 5 and 6 about this idea of the term of Christian compared to the term of being considered a Christ follower or a follower of Jesus. In fact, in chapter 5, you say, in fact, let me be brutally honest, most days I don't even want to be called a Christian. Talk a little bit about that.
I started having these thoughts in the election, probably the election 12 years ago when Obama was first elected. And since then, it's only gotten worse. But I would, under the umbrella of Christian, these awful, terrible, horrible, condemning, judgmental things would be said about whatever was happening in a certain election towards certain people. And we would take our political views and we would use words, and with the rise of social media, you know, you can say these words without any responsibility, without looking someone in the eyes, and you say these horrible things
yeah.
about another human being. And they're Christians, right? And the you know, some of the strongest voices would be the Christian leaders that would be saying things like this. And I can't unravel that, can't figure that out. And we're not going to talk, obviously, here about politics. But you, even on the personal level, you know, you go to Google and you type in Christians are or a Christian is, and you get things like judgmental, annoying, homophobic, you know, all these kinds of things. So there's, it's almost like the term Christian has been discolored, it's been marred, it's got a pretty bad name. And so my thoughts are, you know, the word Christian, like, I don't really care. Like, it's not about a label. It's about a person. It's about our relationship with Jesus and how we build that and how we pull people towards that. And so if the word Christian has been marred so badly that it's no longer helpful, like, I don't have any energy or agenda to change what people think that term means. Like,
right.
I'm sure that's a worthy effort, but
right.
someone else can do that. My thing is, like, how do I live in a way that pulls people towards this person we follow, this Jesus? And I see that the Bible term for that's disciple. It's really not Christian.
Absolutely.
It's, my people will be called my disciples. My disciples will be known by their love for each other. And so that's more my focus. And I'm not going to wear a t-shirt that says I'm a disciple, but I just feel like I've got to figure out unravel what that means and focus more on becoming someone who actually is marked by love, who is known by my love for others, which Jesus called a disciple.
You go into this idea, which I love this. You say in chapter 10, you might be saying to yourself, I think we've all experienced this, whatever, I've tried Jesus. Perhaps you've tried religion. Perhaps you put your faith in a person who claimed to represent Jesus. Perhaps you've been manipulated by one of the many lies embedded in church history. I get that. It is so easy to reject Jesus because of those who purport to be his messengers. We've all seen the intolerance or hate or judgment that has come from the church, and we want to reject it all, throw our baby Jesus out with the bathwater. We've watched power and prestige go to the head of a pastor or priest or televangelist, and it has turned our stomachs. Talk a little bit about that.
I think that's so easy to do, both if you've grown up in the church. You see a lot of people that grow up in the church, and maybe, you know, sometime when they're in their 30s or their 40s or their 50s, they kind of get tired of the game. They get tired of the hypocrisy. They get tired of watching men or women that they really respected fall off, you know, off their pedestals that they put them up on.
Right.
And that can get pretty frustrating. And I think that, you know, for me, that's kind of, it's like, I can't look at that, because that will derail me. I'll check out of the game if that's my focus. If that's where I put people and that's what I expect of people. And so I just have to kind of fix my eyes on Jesus, which I know is a very churchy Christianese thing to say. But what does that mean? And for me, that means, okay, you know, study his life through the Gospels. In fact, I'd say if someone, you know, someone listening is kind of in that, where they're kind of like checking out, or they're just, their stomach's turned by the hypocrisy around them, or they're just not sure, like, just stop reading your Bible for a while, and just focus on Jesus. And then when you come back to it, just focus on the Gospel, on just the life of Jesus.
Yeah.
And how he treated people, and how he spoke to people, and how he responded to people, and how he met people at their place of need. Like, for me, like, there's a whole lot. I mean, there's theologians that have multi years of education and degrees, and believe strongly what they believe. And I'm never going to be that person. I'm never going to be able to unravel and find out what does Leviticus mean for my life. I'm just not going to figure that out. Or, you know, what are all these horses and horns and animals in Revelation? How does that affect? I don't know. So, and I'm not saying people shouldn't study that, and there shouldn't be really smart people unraveling that. That's great. But for me, like, I don't know about that. But what I do know is, like, I could work for the rest of my life, and if the only thing I tried to work on was how to love people better, like, I don't know if I'd ever arrive, right? I mean, it's just going to be, that's going to be a lifelong journey. And so for me, like, that's a worthy journey. That's something I can focus on. It's tangible. I mean, it's like, I know today, you can kind of think in your head, like, I know today something I can do to love someone better, to love someone well, to love someone who's at a point of need or crisis or transition. And so that's kind of my focus.
Yeah.
Trying to be my focus, I should say.
Yeah, that's so good. I recently, I have a customer, and he grew up, I don't know where he grew up, but he obviously grew up, maybe, you know, kind of under government rule or so forth. And so in our emails, we haven't met face to face, but, or we've met by video, but we haven't met face to face. And so we started emailing, and as we're working on a project together, he had shared something with me, and I'd shared something with him. And then he emailed me back, and he said, I put this down here. He said to me, I did note that you are a religious/spiritual person. And he said, I'm not religious, because of my experiences with the government that he grew up under. And he said they were using religion as a control tool/weapon. But I am very spiritual, and was raised with parents who always said to me, there's a loving God watching and helping. I strongly believe in do to others as you want them to do to you. And I responded back. I said, wow, this is good news, because we're on the same page, because I'm not religious either. And I said, I think God's not religious. You know, in fact, I think he welcomes spirituality over religion, because that speaks to more of who we are and not the things we have to do and how we, you know, interact with others as well. So I do think that's that's a cloud that, you know, when you go down that road, that's a cloud that can get dark pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Jesus, in the Gospels, in his life that's recorded on those first four books of the New Testament, you find that, like, his harsh words, like, you think about Christians today, our harsh words are for, you know, pick whatever, maybe they're for the liberals, maybe they're for the right wing, you know, nuts, maybe, who knows, but our harsh words are kind of towards the world, if you want to say that, the outside the church, you know, the world around us, it's towards the abortion advocates, or it's toward, you know, we've got these categories of people. Jesus' harshest words were for, like, the pastors, like, of his day, the priests, yeah, the religious leaders. Yeah. I mean, that's where he really, if you look at, like, when he seemed to, like, get worked up and ticked off, it was towards the religious leaders that were imposing on people things that didn't come from him, things that were not part of. So that's, you know, I look at that and I think, okay, that's not that I need to be judgmental towards Christian leaders. I'm not saying that's the example. I'm saying the thing I should follow is, like, what was he saying? He was saying, it's not about the rules. It's not about the duties. You know, sometimes you have to step away from it. You have to do a little bit of, especially if you've grown up in a highly religious / rules oriented philosophy or church or family. Sometimes you have to step away a bit, get a little detox, just kind of get it out of your system, and then let it rebuild. And, like, okay, what is it? What does this mean for me? What's the core of what I should, not what other people think I should be doing, but really, what is the core of what Jesus calls me to do?
Yep, absolutely. Chapter 17, you go into this idea of proximity, the principle of proximity. I love this because sometimes when you think about, you know, this concept of love and so forth, you may say, well, I mean, I kind of get it, but how does it, you know, how do I mean, go love somebody? Sure, you know, but how does that work? But talk a little bit about this idea of, you know, not feeling like you have to save the world, but you know, why not just make a difference with the people that we, you know, are closest to or bump up against?
So I think that we have this sense that you know, we're supposed to, you know, God so loved the world, so I have to love the whole world. And I think, like, God so loved the world, but I'm supposed to love my neighbor. That's kind of what God has called me to. We can easily kind of check the box in our life for, like, I have loved well when we write a, you know, $25 check and give it to that organization that supports that orphanage that's in India. Yeah. And, like, I think there's times we should absolutely do that, and God calls us to do that. But I think more than that, or in addition to that, or on top of that, he calls us just to love the people that he brings across our path. So when the Bible says we're supposed to love our neighbor, and when Jesus said, my disciples are known by their love for each other, I think, like, our neighbor is not, maybe it's the person that lives next door. It probably is. But more than that, it's just the people that God brings across our path. So it's the person in the cubicle that's next to me at the office that I know, like, just went through a horrendous divorce and is really struggling and has no place to go for Thanksgiving. Or it's the person that we run to at the grocery store and we see often, that's the teller or that's bagging the groceries or whatever. And it's like, now, those are the people that, like, because of proximity, I'm called to help them. When Hurricane Harvey came through Houston here last year, and the first hurricane for my family, and, you know, I think there's a sense of, and when a national disaster happens anywhere, there's a sense of, like we should jump in and help. And it's like, absolutely. And God's going to call some people to go across the country or across the world to help in something like that. But I think, as a Houstonian, like, I have more responsibility to help the people, like, the people I actually know who lost their homes and lost everything and didn't have insurance. Like, they're my neighbor, and I am responsible to love them, whatever that means. Maybe I can't buy them a new house, but can I buy them some clothes or blankets or have a place for them to stay or whatever it is? And those are the things. I think the principle of proximity says, like, just keep open your eyes, like, every day, like, who does God want me to love on today? Create space in your life so you have time to actually do that. And just love those that come across your path.
Yeah, and one of the obstacles, I think, that prevent us sometimes from doing that and from, you know, particularly in the people we know, is our struggle And many times as Christ followers, we struggle maybe more than anybody, but our struggle with forgiveness. And you talk about that, and I love the part where you defined the difference between trust and forgiveness. I've never heard that before, and it was really good to unpack that a little bit as you were thinking about when some people, you know, they're wronged and they think, well, you want me to forgive the person, but, you know, how do I ever trust them again? And you clearly unpack that.
Well, forgiveness is such a tough thing. I mean, if your wife, you know, was just raped by a neighbor, like, what do you do with that?
Right.
I mean, and you can't just go to that person and, you know, very tritely say, well, you need to forgive. Forgiveness is like, it's a journey. It takes a while to get there. We have great examples in the New Testament of forgiveness. And you get to a point when someone's wronged you, if you're marked by love, if you're attempting to follow Jesus, you get to a point, it may take you 6 months, it may take you 3 years, but you get to a point where I can forgive this person. But forgive doesn't necessarily mean that you should let them back in and trust them 100% again.
Yeah.
You know, if your kid takes your car and they wreck it, and you forgive them, you genuinely forgive them. They didn't mean to do this. They're remorseful. You forgive them. It doesn't mean you're going to get them another car that they get the keys right away.
Right.
I mean, that has to be rebuilt over time. Folks that are like in abusive relationships and they've been, I mean, deeply wounded by a family member, by a spouse, by a parent, like you can get to a place where you can forgive, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't have distance in that relationship just for safety.
Yeah.
And for rebuilding your own, you know, just emotional psyche. I think forgiveness and trust are two different things, and we can forgive and still put boundaries, and we can forgive and say, you know what, I don't hold this against you anymore, but I also can't have you in my life every day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're going to have some boundaries in this relationship. So that's, I mean, and I don't think forgiveness is a once and for all. I mean, recently my wife and I went through a tough thing the last couple of years with betrayal from a friend, and just deeply wounded us. And for me, forgiveness is, it's a choice. But it's not just a once and for all choice. It's like, okay, like I got to forgive her again today.
Yeah.
And I got to forgive her again tomorrow, you know? So, and also like, I'm also have some distance there because that trust has to be rebuilt.
Yeah. I think when I read that, I thought, wow, you know, most people who try to open that door of forgiveness think it's a, you know, a barn door that you have to open back up in your life and say, okay, and they can't do that. And I really loved how you segmented that and said, you know, it's not, forgiveness is not just a, you know, Katie bar the door, you know, kind of thing. It's, you know, forgiveness is one thing. Trust is something else. Boundaries are okay. Even when you forgive, you can still have those. So, so helpful. So helpful.
I mean, it's something that gets tested.
Yeah.
About the time you think, yeah, I'm pretty good at this, then something else comes in your life and you realize, and it might even be something little that you just can't let go, and it's really like, so it's like, okay, I guess I haven't gotten my college degree on forgiveness yet. So
a couple chapters later, you talk about you tell this grass cutting story, which I chuckled about your neighbor who's wants to water his lawn 24 hours a day, not really, but a lot. And it was draining on the corner of your yard and keeping that part of your yard wet. And that was so funny. And I think I knew a little bit about you that you kind of liked, you know, a nice yard and all that. That just brought a smile to my face. But in that chapter, you moved to this idea of three things to be more loving. You say create space is number one. Number two, remove the things that make you unloving. Number three, pray for a change of heart. If you might want to just, you know, kind of unpack those a little bit. You know, it's not rocket science, not meant to be, but wow, it's so practical.
I find in my life, if I'm like scheduled from the time I wake up till the time I go to bed, which often I am, and if my budget is just just enough to cover the expenses that I'm expecting, then I don't have time in my life or money in my budget or emotional space to be able to help someone who's in need. And so that principle proximity, God brings someone along my path who's in need, and like I'm uniquely positioned proximity-wise to make a difference in their life and to love them in some tangible way. But yet I don't have space for that. I ain't got enough time for that, you know.
Right.
Someone, you know, peeks their head in your office, or they're on the elevator and they're crying, or you run into them in the parking garage, and or they're on the side of the road changing a tire, or whatever it is. It's like, I mean, if we're like booked, like solid, we don't have time. We don't have time to love. If we, you know, someone has a financial need, and like, man, $100 is going to make a difference in this single mom's life. But yet we're so cramped because of our lifestyle choices that we can't help. Like, we want to help and we'll pat them on the back. We just can't. So margin, that creating space in your life, is just like, create space in your schedule, both, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, and on an annual basis, create space in your finances. And if you create space, then as those things that God brings across your path, they're not going to be pressures. They're going to be like, no, this is what I was made to do. This wasn't on my calendar, but this is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing in this moment. And you have space to do it. And then also, you know, remove the things that make you unloving. So for me, the illustration I tell in the book is, it was cable news. I found I was a cable news junkie. Like, it would be on probably an hour and a half, 2 hours every night. It would be on my car radio anytime I was in my car. And so what I found, and I loved it. I love the politics. I love the debates during elections. I love the commentary. What does this person think that meant? What does this other person think that meant? Loved it all. But I realized that was making me like anxious. Like, every day I was like, okay, I think the whole world is falling apart because these commentators on TV told me it is. And there's some decision being made in the state government or national government. And if it goes this way, like, we're going to be Nazi Germany tomorrow, because that's just what these commentators told me was going to happen. And so I found that by removing that, I just kind of like just stopped completely tuning in on any of that, and found that like I no longer felt hopelessly defeated. I became less cynical. I started actually thinking like these politicians on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, they're actually human beings. They actually don't hate America. Right. They actually want the best. They think about things maybe differently, but they want the best. And so I had to, that was for me, I had to remove that. For someone else, you know, it might be a relationship. It might be a job. It might be you go to the job every day and you come home just cynical and negative and gossipy. And like, you might have to remove that piece. Find another job. I mean, just begin to pray about God finding you something else, but whatever it is, it's like, you know, pull the things out of your life that make it really difficult for you to take any steps on this loving life that we're after.
Couple more things here. You mentioned, and this is, wow, I mean, this is one of those things that I think we're facing in this world today, but you say we establish, chapter 23, you say we establish our position, we hang out with people who think like us, and then we attack those who disagree. It is us versus them. And we find energy in establishing our position and destroying people on the other side. And the reason that struck me, I interviewed Dr. Dan Boone. He's the president of Trevecca University, where my son Fletcher goes to school. And he's written a bunch of books. And I've, usually when he writes something, you know, it's social media or whatever, I usually pay attention to it because he does it in such a way. And when I interviewed him on the podcast, I said, how do you do that? In other words, he's very clear about his position. In other words, you don't read his position, you know, in a university, if there's something controversial or whatever, you don't read it and say, well, I don't know where he stands. You know, he's on both sides of the fence. You're very clear, but it never feels judgmental. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, I try to write so that it's done in a way that it begins the conversation, never meant to end the conversation. And I thought, wow, that is so powerful. So hard to do, but so powerful in today's world, because we we have this tendency that we want to be, you know, we don't want a conversation. We want to always be the last word.
It, you know, and the internet, it has made that like all the more, it's just kind of elevated it because we no longer have to look people in the eyes to have the last word. And so we can be banging away at our keyboard or clicking away on our phone and say things that are going to go out that the entire world has access to 3 seconds after we hit, you know, hit send. And we have no thought about how does that affect the person I was just talking about, their family, their kids, when they read, you know, what people are saying about their dad or their mom, you know, whatever it is. We tend to, it's like we have these, you know, we kind of build these foxholes on either side of this war, and we're kind of lobbing our grenades back and forth. And nothing's ever changed except people are getting hurt.
Yeah.
And positions aren't moving. Positions aren't changing. I talk in the book about the key for me, two things. One is to engage in those conversations, like you mentioned with Dr. Boone, engage in those conversations doing one, assuming the best. We often go into conversations, we feel slighted that the person did not assume best of our motivations or what we meant, but we often don't assume the best of theirs either.
Yeah.
And so going into conversations and not assuming that someone hates us or hates Jesus or hates people, but assuming the best. And the second thing is like seeking to understand. It was, I think Dr. Covey said, seek first to understand. And he stole that from Augustine or someone from way back.
Right.
But like, if you go into a conversation where you know this person's position on whatever it is diametrically opposed to yours, instead of like, how do I convince them? Or how do I make sure that people know I don't agree with them? To walk into it, just asking questions about their background and their history and how they came to those, to their view on life or their view on this particular topic, and really seeking to understand. And in doing that, we express love and dignity to other people. And we further the conversation when you can actually have a civil conversation about things that you may disagree about, and you may talk openly about that, but you treat people with dignity. That makes such a huge difference in those conversations and in the relationship and in the dialogue that other people are watching.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that, make sure people know, if you've got a pen, write this down. I mean, these were two nuggets that are, if you take anything away from the book, I mean, you'll take a lot away from the book, but these two were extremely powerful. We could apply this in our, I mean, gosh, the world would be a better place. But those two things, number one, assume the best about people. Gosh. Yeah, absolutely. And number two, the seek first to understand. Man, that, what a difference that would make. I love the illustration you gave about, I think it was a friend of yours or whatever, and in their office, kind of over the door or whatever, kind of behind a person they may be talking to that would walk in, they have the word waste, WAIST. You know, what in the world does that mean? And it stands, an acronym that stands for, why am I still talking? So powerful. You end the book with a familiar chapter for those of us and who are Christ followers or have dug into Scripture a little bit. 1 Corinthians 13, it was a chapter that was read at my wedding. Although it's always interesting when I teach on that, I say, you guys know that was never meant for weddings. That was,
yeah.
It wasn't like Paul was saying, well, here's a good marriage scripture. But the end of that obviously sort of puts the cherry on top of where you are going with the book. But it says three things, you know, will last forever: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. And you certainly highlighted that in such a tremendous, tremendous way. I jotted down in my notes, I don't know where I read this, and maybe you've heard this, but one author said, you know why love is the greatest? It's not because it's, you know, necessarily better than the others or whatever, is that when that day comes, you know, and we're sitting in eternity, you know, with Jesus or whatever, we won't need faith anymore. You know, we won't have to have any faith. That will be irrelevant at that time. And we won't need hope, because that'll be irrelevant. But the one thing that will continue into eternity that we will always need is the ability to love each other.
That's good. Yeah. And I go back to you know, like what is tangible, like what's under my control. And you know, it's hard to love fully without you know, having a relationship with the source of love and a relationship with Jesus. So
yeah,
I'm not saying that it's 100% our control, and we as we build that relationship, God gives us more grace and ability to love others well. But there are tangible things I can do every single day when I wake up to love others, and some of the tangibility of that comes in responsiveness. Just how am I going to respond in a really tough situation? How am I going to be proactive? How am I going to have a better attitude? How am I going to stop saying the gossipy, judgmental things I'm saying in front of my kids about other people? I mean, there's tangible things that we can work on that. And so for me, like, that's just like, that's the focus of my life right now, is just like, okay, how can I love better? And every day you're going to fail in that, and every day you're going to have some successes in that. And just each day we're trying to do a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love the book. As I said earlier, I applaud you for being so transparent and being willing to sort of dive into the weeds at times, you know, of your weeds, I guess is what I'm saying, of opening up your heart and sharing some of your misfortunes and your struggles, as we all do. And I think it's going to be meaningful for, you know, anybody who takes the time to dig into that. I hope they'll do so. Obviously, you can get the book, I guess, anywhere, Amazon, and where all books are sold. It's out and about. And how would people get in touch with you? I know you have a couple of, you know, at Vanderbloom, and also you have a blog that you write as a part of. And yeah, so how would people connect with you?
So a couple ways. If they're interested in the book, there's a chapter, you can download a chapter if you want to kind of like test it, markedbylove.com. You can go on there and find a chapter to download. I think it's one of the ones you referenced. It's towards the beginning of the book. And then I do blog at leadingsmart.com, and they can also contact me through that. I try to put out a new article with some fresh content every Tuesday morning. And then love to, you know, love to connect with folks if they want to talk more about this, or more about how we can help them through Vanderblumen with a search. Love to talk about that as well.
Yep. Sounds great. Hey, thanks. Thanks for the time. I loved talking to you, and always do. Always learn something. Just thanks for being on the podcast.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Great stuff from Tim. I always enjoy talking to him, and just tremendous wisdom. I always gain such insight from not only just talking to him, but his books that I've read. I encourage you to check that out. You can find him, as he mentioned, in markedbylove.com, leadingsmart.com, and vanderblumen.com. And I'll put those links in the notes so you can easily find them. So until next week, remember, watch out for those blind spots and make sure you have someone in your life to help you see clearly. See you next time.